Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, before we get going, this is Aaron. I'm one of the hosts of this show. I have a new podcast coming out. It's called Stoner. I talk to creative, interesting people who enjoy marijuana. If you like this show, I think you might like hearing me talk somewhere else about something else. We'll have on artists and musicians, also people who work within the marijuana industry. If it's not for you, maybe tell your most stonery friend. At the end of this episode, we'll have a little teaser for it so you can hear a little bit about what it's all about. If you listen, thank you. Here's the show. Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff.
What's up, you guys?
Hey, Aaron. I understand that you did an interview for this week's show.
I did. It's with Hrishikesh Hirway, who is behind Song Exploder, which is a podcast I greatly enjoy.
It's a music podcast, and each episode is one song, he breaks it down.
It's with the musician. It's a musician breaking down their own song, explaining how they made it. In terms of why I was interested in having him on this show, he's pretty clear to say he does not consider what he does music journalism or music criticism, but I think it has some of the same aims as those things, and it's an interesting way to tell the story behind music in a way that feels really direct and right from the person who made it.
I feel like it's telling about Song Exploder that you, Aaron Lammer, who like knows everything about music, and me, Max Linsky, who has zero taste and knows nothing, both really enjoy Song Exploder.
Song Exploder is really interesting to me, because you very rarely get to hear multi-track breakdown. Like, you could listen to music your whole life and never hear isolated tracks. There was only one. There's one other show. There's a show called BBC Classic Albums that shows like artists in the studio with their like original tapes, and you can hear individual tracks. But in the same way, I hope that this show maybe gives people an idea of how pieces of nonfiction, magazine articles, are constructed. You often don't get a peek into that world. You see the edited, finished product, and you don't understand what the ingredients are. So it's a real privilege. He's done 100 episodes to be able to hear what the drums sound like on this song. How is this sample chopped in this exact portion of the song?
Also, you can't. They're not that long, but you can't listen to just one. That's what happened to me. I started listening to artists that I like.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, I'm listening to artists I never heard of. And then picking up their music from there.
I don't know if you guys have favorites, but my favorite is the BoJack one.
The BoJack Horseman theme song is really excellent. I also highly recommend the Composer of Moonlights episode is really interesting. But as a whole, I think as we sort of do this show and cross our first decade here doing this every week, I'm more and more interested in people who are doing things at the periphery of journalism and doing journalism in new ways and figuring out different ways to tell the same stories, like what is this song, that have existed since forever.
Aaron, if you wanted to tell some new stories in a new way, how would you do it?
I find a way that is reliable to contact people is email. And the only reliable way to send email is with MailChimp. They are our sponsor. Thank you, MailChimp.
14 million people using MailChimp. All three of us are in that group of 14 million.
I actually have two MailChimp accounts now.
Now here's Aaron with Hrishikesh Hirway.
Well,
Welcome, Hrishikesh Hirway.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Aaron.
Give people the very, very brief elevator. When you meet a person at a bar, what is Song Exploder?
Sometimes I have to explain what a podcast is first, but then
I had my first interview that started with what is a podcast a couple of weeks ago.
That's always great. That's great. So Song Exploder is a podcast where musicians take apart their songs and piece by piece tell the story of how they were made. And that's how I start every episode, just in case somebody's coming to it for the very first time and they've never heard of it. That's what they hear on the show.
You work in the same terrain as a music writer or a music critic, but I would never describe you as either of those things literally. How do you relate what you're doing to these more established canonical forms of music journalism media?
Yeah, I don't know how it fits or if it fits in there at all. The thing that I feel like I've related it to most is, well, there's two things. One is sort of like a remix, and the other is like more like a design project. Mm. And I think that those two are related. They're certainly related, at least in my own mind, and the way that I go about both of those things, because I think that for journalists, and having no background in journalism and having never been like in a newsroom or had to really deal with some of these questions, I feel like there are different rules for journalism, like a more stringent adherence to like documenting what somebody's saying and how they're saying it, where you might cut down for content. You know, you might skip a question or something like that, or you might even cut people saying or to clean up the flow of a conversation. But generally there's this sense of you're presenting a recording of what the person said. And I'm technically not doing that. I'm like presenting what I think people mean and trying to present what they mean in the best sort of like most articulate, most like beautiful way I can possibly present it, I think. And I feel like I end up breaking what would probably be rules for a regular journalist.
Does that have to do with sort of coaching people? Like, I'm curious how people tell their stories so well. How much do you have to intervene to guide those stories into such a like articulate and sort of resonant whole?
There's some stuff that's definitely happening on the interview side, but I would say most of it is happening on the editing side.
Interesting.
And so, you know, just like the way making a song has, like, sometimes the actual path is meandering, but even just talking about how a song is made, you know, you forget stuff and you come back to it, and, you know, they talk about the drums and then later I ask them about a bass thing and they're like, oh, actually, no, this other thing came first, you know, and so it gets told all out of sequence. And then it's up to me to kind of like condense those things and put it in order. And so this is where it starts to feel like a design project too. Like, it's a little bit of a puzzle of putting the things together in the most logical way and easy to digest way. And I'm thinking a little bit more about who's hearing it than I am about who's saying it, or like I have more fidelity, I think, to the person who's hearing it than the person who's saying it. I'm taking some liberties, or maybe I'm taking actually kind of like a lot of liberties with their words and cutting things up and, you know, like Frankensteining sentences together. Like, oh, there's a lot of stuff on Song Exploder where an idea starts from one part of the interview, the middle is from another part of the interview, and the end of the sentence is from another part of the interview. But I know, because I was there for the whole thing, I know what they meant.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you would think of that as taking a greater liberty than, to me, like, say, a musician's profile, in which someone goes and hangs out with someone for 2 hours and then, like, clips like two sentences of quotes is like, whoa, you've like excluded almost everything that happened. In a way, like, when I hear a Song Exploder, I don't necessarily assume it's linear, but I assume that it's sort of true to the heart and soul of how they represented their song.
I mean, I hope so, but that's the thing. I guess, you know, you never really, you don't know. And I am cutting out, I am kind of doing that, and where I'm spending like an hour to an hour and a half with them and then just putting out 10 minutes of them of talking from that. But I am trying to be as empathetic as possible and you know, one thing that I definitely am also doing that's different from maybe how a journalist might approach it is I'm trying to make them look good as much as possible.
Right.
There's absolutely zero interest in trying to like reveal something. I'd never, ever, ever want an artist to hear an episode that I've made and have them feel bad about how it turned out or embarrassed or anything like that.
How long has the show existed now?
Just over 3 years.
3 years. Okay. So it feels part of a wave both in the internet and with music itself, at least in my experience as a listener. I remember going on things like what is now known as Genius for the first time, or a site like Who Sampled, that are these sort of rich troves of information that previously just didn't exist. Like there previously was not a, you know, a comprehensive database of sample usage, or something I think of in Song Exploders. I remember prior to your show, only 3 or 4 times had I heard someone do a multi-track isolated breakdown of a song, which is like a hugely informative process if you've never had the experience of like listening to, say, studio tapes and breaking them down. It's very counterintuitive what a lot of stuff sounds like. I kind of remember there was like a BBC classic album series where they sometimes sit at the desk and do it, but that was like the only time I'd have heard it. Now you're at episode 100. It feels like there's something of a movement that takes a lot of its influence from information and from sort of charting uncharted territory in a documentarian archivist kind of way rather than a critic's role. Was there stuff that you were thinking about when you started out with the show wanting to emulate or build upon?
I think the primary thing was just the sounds of the stems, of the isolated elements themselves. Whether I would be making my own music or listening to somebody else's music in their studio or something that they're working on, whenever I would get to hear, you know, the soloed track of just like, oh, this is what just the guitars sound like, or this is what all the vocal harmonies, if you just listen to those, this is what it sounds like. That's like some of my favorite, most satisfying moments of making music and experiencing music as a musician. But there was something kind of private and insider about it. And so there was a selfish part where, you know, Sufjan Stevens did this thing on one of his records where there's this violin section in one of the songs. And he did something that I was like, wow, I would totally love to do that. I thought it was really ballsy and awesome that the song plays. And then the next track, the name of the track is something like, Let's Hear Those Strings Again. And it's just the string part from the song.
Yeah.
It's like a minute long of just the strings of the track that you just heard. And it's a track on the CD. And that kind of played into an instinct that I've had a lot where I'm like, oh man, I worked so hard on this string arrangement or this horn arrangement or whatever. And I'm listening to it here and nobody else gets to hear it. Wouldn't it be cool if there were a way to let other people hear it?
I have something of like a stoner's tendency to find like almost every isolated track kind of beautiful. Is it hard for you to be selective and say like, yeah, this isolated track, this is the interesting one to listen to? Like, how do you zero in on when you take a song and start taking it apart? What are going to be the important parts to tell the story?
Well, that's the nice thing about combining with the interview, you know. There have been times when a band will take like a song and they'll just upload the stems on SoundCloud and you can just listen to it, you know, the 3-minute song track by track. And that's cool and kind of neat, but combining it with the story about the song gives it some framework. And so sometimes I will leave out a stem because there's no good story around about it, you know, or I might end up using it if it's really beautiful and there's not a good story about it, or there's nothing particularly interesting that's said of it. I can still use it as like score. So there is this other textural way that I can pull it into the episode. But usually I pick what's going to be in there, sort of balancing both how beautiful the stem is and then how great the story is that goes along with it.
How do you deal with the issue of, like, I was actually even worried when we started this show. This show, I felt like very inspired by Marc Maron's show.
Same.
I always thought with Maron, I was like, well, those are all comedians. They're incredibly good talker. Like, they're people who talk professionally. What I've discovered with this show with Longform is that people who write for a living and have to like articulate ideas and also often do radio, and they're also pretty good at talking. It's a pretty self-selecting pool of people who can talk. With musicians, I don't always associate like people who are great at writing music with being great about talking about writing music. Like, how do you deal with people who what they do happens at some subconscious level and they're not necessarily used to articulating it in an interview kind of capacity?
Yeah, no, I feel like you're being very diplomatic about the idea that musicians can be really boring when they talk. But as a musician, I feel I have no qualms saying that. And it's also part of the reason why I get nervous about being on this show.
Yeah.
Because you do have such articulate speakers and, you know, people who can write and connect their thoughts so eloquently. These are all things that I don't do well and would hate when I was the few times, you know, when I would have to do press for my own band. It always kind of pained me and stressed me out.
Yeah.
And still stresses me out now. But this is where Song Exploder was kind of designed around these limitations, but the idea that I don't want to have to talk, and also that potentially 60 to 80% of what a musician says during an interview might be boring to all but the most diehard of fans. So that's why the episodes are so short, but the interviews are so long. You know, if I can talk to somebody for 80 or 90 minutes, then I'm sure that they can say, five or six really interesting things, or at least four or five pretty interesting things, and two or three incredibly profound things about their own work.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, MeUndies. If you're like me, you probably don't think very much about your underwear. You just buy them when you're buying some clothes and then keep them forever. That is a terrible way to live. Not only do you have some crappy old rundown underwear, but you never really know when to replace them. There's a better way, MeUndies. They are seriously soft, feel-good undies delivered right to your door. Designed in LA, made from sustainably sourced, micromodal fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. The best part, in my opinion, is you can save time and you can save money each month by opting for a monthly subscription. But even if you're not ready for that, that's okay. You can still save. You can get 20% off your first pair when you go to MeUndies.com/longform. So go ahead, revamp your underwear drawer. You've earned it. Once again, MeUndies.com/longform for 20% off your first pair, and you'll be supporting the show. Thank you, MeUndies. Here I am back with Hrishikesh Hirway. I accept what you say about a distinction between what you're doing and journalism or criticism. But if you're doing 80 or 90 minutes worth of interview and you're putting out a product that has, what, about 20 minutes of interview in it?
More like 8 to 12
minutes of interview.
Average.
What you're doing is on some level writing. You're taking the raw material of a bunch of interview bits and writing what I think often comes across like a very well-written essay out of them. I'm curious how you develop that skill and how it's evolved over 100 episodes, that sense of the essay within the episode.
That's interesting. I never have thought about it as writing. Actually, one time I remember Roman Mars used the phrase writing with other people's words when he was talking about how he builds a 99% Invisible episode, where he condenses the information from the interview and then, you know, kind of writes around stuff. And I was kind of jealous of that. And again, I don't feel totally comfortable doing that, like coming in and doing like the explainer around their words. So I never really thought of it as writing. It definitely felt like I was just editing. This is maybe where it felt more like a remix to me, because I felt like I was given other people's work, their other people's ideas and thoughts and music. And then my job is just to try and create something that has like with any song, it has a place where it starts and there's some kind of emotional content to it, and you try and build an arc into it, and you try and have it end with some level of satisfaction. And there are little stakes and things that you build into it to try and do that. So I think, I guess maybe, I don't know if this is entirely true, but probably the closest thing I could give to an answer is maybe it comes from music.
Interesting. Well, I assume a lot of these people you can't have like unlimited time with. What, like, do right. you ask for like at least a certain amount of time to be able to pull off an episode?
I ask for at least an hour. I don't always get it.
Wow.
With Bono, they were like, you have 15 minutes.
and does that like, is that a like potentially like, oh shit, I just don't even want to do it then? Or are you just like, no, we'll figure out how to do it with 15 minutes?
Yeah. I mean, you know, so there, at least it wasn't the only interview. They said I had 30 minutes with The Edge and 15 minutes with Bono. So that was a little bit risky, but I did the Edge interview first, and we hit the 30 minute mark, and I was trying to wrap up, you know, being like, I was like, hey, thank you so much for talking to me. And but then he kind of blew past me and like kept going, and we weren't in the same place. They were in Canada on tour and I was here in LA, and so I was texting the publicist at the same time, and I was like, hey, I'm sorry, I tried to end it. I know you know he has to go. And she wrote back and she was like, no, that means that he's into it, like it's totally cool. And I think like partly that time limit is imposed for their client's safety or security. So we ended up talking for like 45 minutes and he was great. And so I felt like I was on pretty solid ground by the time I got to the interview later that day with Bono. You know, I had pretty solid footing. If I had to do them in the other order, it would have been a totally different story. But there I was just like, all right, I've got the meat of the story and I just need a couple of good reactions to things that The Edge said, or, you know, just a couple of new insights about the parts that were uniquely Bono's, like the lyrics of the song were really largely based on his own biography.
Do you have an idea of what kind of music, what kind of a person is going to make a great episode now? Like, do you have to like the song for it to work for you?
I don't. I think it would be a limitation if I did, because, you know, that would be too arrogant, I think, if I tried to limit the show to music that I liked, because there's too much music out there that's really loved and that people are really interested in that falls outside of my own personal tastes for me to limit it that way. So, of course, I'm interested in artists that are really successful and famous and who have a big following, just for the sake of the show, having people who are, you know, tuning in and listening to it. And then I'm also trying to find people specifically who sound different from, you know, whoever it was that was on last episode. If I can have a punk band and an R&B artist and a rapper and a metal band, you know, like within the course of 2 months, then I can feel like, all right, this is good. I'm proving some kind of underlying thesis of Song Exploder, which is that regardless of what you think of the song, there's something to be said and something to be gained from understanding how this piece of work was made. There's like a sub-narrative of creativity and inspiration and just like the idea of work, and that like creativity and art, there's like this work component to it. And there are all these little ideas that end up getting knitted together.
You yourself have been in bands. Your main project is 1AM Radio.
That's been the thing that I started that when I was in college, and has been like kind of a through line for music for most of my adult life. These days, I'm not really working on it so much, just because I don't know for a bunch of different reasons. And so the project that I've been focused on most musically is this new band called Moors.
Okay. When you first thought of doing this show, I'm also curious, most of the podcast world and most of the media, at least outside of the like bigger, more funded This American Life kind of operations, is kind of casual, a little bit sloppy, kind of like turn on the mics and let it happen. Maybe we edit it. Maybe it just goes straight on the internet. And your show is intensely meticulous. Like, I can't even count how many cuts there must be per minute. I never hear like an off note at all in it. what inspired you to approach the show that way? Is that just like how you are? And how did you feel about investing so much time and so much energy into really a pretty labor intensive show when I assume the audience wasn't huge episode one?
Yeah. Well, the first part feels a little bit like I didn't have a choice. I think that's just how I am about everything, for better, for worse, and oftentimes for worse. Like, especially, I think, as somebody who's primarily been involved in like creative things, meticulousness is definitely not always a strength. And this just happens to be a place where I think it works, you know, where I was able to take that annoying part of me, you know, it's the same, like making a record for me is incredibly painful and takes so long, you know, like between my first and second record, it took me 2 years. And then between the next one, it was 3 years. And then between the next one, it was 4 years because like, I just can't, finish things, you know, and there's a nice thing about Songing Splitter where there are these external deadlines that I've set up where I'm like, okay, I'm putting out these episodes on this, on these days. And so I kind of have to stop. But otherwise, if I didn't have those, I definitely would not have put out as many episodes so far. And
I mean, the bar you've set for yourself is pretty extreme. You're averaging, what, about 3 episodes a month?
Yeah.
Like, there's people who have, like, entire offices of people to produce, like, that much material. How did you decide, hey, I'm just going to do 3 episodes a month?
Originally, it was 2 episodes a month. Because I was doing a lot more music around that time. In the first year, I was touring a bunch and I was working on a film score. And so I was like, I think I can maintain a two episode a month schedule. But I started to realize that people who put out shows more frequently, they just kind of were in the public consciousness more, I felt like. Or you know, maybe this is a mistake. I might be mistaking the public consciousness for Twitter.
But you're not the first person who's made that mistake.
But it felt like, you know, the more you put out, then that's another chance for to be the subject of a conversation between people, and trying to get people to tune in and discover this. This felt very much like related to what I've gone through with music, where you know you're always trying to figure out how to stay relevant, not have people forget about your band between records, between tours, between songs.
I assume you didn't start this thinking like, this is going to be my full-time living, I'm going to like just make this podcast, but it seems like it's evolved into something that is a pretty like deep and rich enterprise for you. You're doing stuff with Google Play Music, you do live shows. I mean, you've built a lot of infrastructure out of the podcast.
Yeah. No, I definitely didn't think that it was going to be full-time. And part of the reason why it switched was because music stuff just kind of slowed down. And then I was like, I could put out a third episode. Like I had the time at that moment. And so I did that for the next couple months. And I felt like there was some proof to that idea that like, okay, if I put out more stuff, I knew I couldn't make it be a weekly show. But I started to understand things about the power of a weekly show, that when you put out something and people can expect it. You know, the crazy thing about the 3 episodes a month schedule is nobody has any idea when Song Exploder comes out. Like, right. People don't even know how to describe the schedule. You know, they're like, oh, this week's episode. I'm like, yeah, but there's no episode next week. You know, it's alternating Mondays and Thursdays, which is essentially nothing. That means nothing to anybody. But I at least got the lesson from people who are making weekly shows of like how awesome it is for their audience to be able to feel like, hey, this is a part of my life. I turn on, you know, just like the way somebody would consume a TV show and being able to look forward to something coming out. And then I just never stopped doing 3 episodes a month.
And now you're at 100.
Yeah. I wish sometimes that I could go back to 2 episodes a month because it feels a little bit overwhelming when music stuff comes up, and I'm trying to do that too. And then now I do have a weekly show that I'm doing, the West Wing Weekly. So there are months where it feels like trying to put out music and 7 episodes in 4 weeks of 2 different shows is just like too much. And then when we were working on the Google podcast, I think like in the month of January, I realized I'd made 10 episodes of 3 different shows and I was just not sleeping.
I mean, when you're working that much, are you just basically every single hour of every day is mapped out? Like, okay, I do this show this day, I do that. Like, that just seems like a feat of endurance to me.
Yeah. I mean, the other part of it that makes it hard is I'm really bad with time management and I feel like not very disciplined. So I don't know how to structure this stuff. So that, and then combined with also not being able to let go and like finish a thing, makes it really hard. I was pulling all-nighters for several nights in a row.
I think a lot of people fantasize, a lot of people who listen to the show fantasize about like, I'll start some creative project, it'll take off, it'll go all, have all sorts of different tentacles, and I'll be able to do it as my job. And it, you know, it can sound like a dream come true, which it is. And I think that you've put in enough work that no one could say you got lucky. But I wonder how it feels to have achieved that level of success with what you're doing and where you go from there. And yeah, like, well, what's the emotional experience been like?
It's a little bit bittersweet, honestly. First, I love the idea that somebody would listen to an episode and then the feeling that they would have afterwards is, now I want to make something. That's like the yes. best possible reaction, like whether it's music or not, just the idea that like, I want to make something, because that is the thing that I love most, getting that feeling from stuff, like going to a show or hearing a record or watching a movie or reading a book or whatever it is, or just whatever experience, and being able to have that and then feel like I can make something. I know how to make something, or I want to make something. That is really important to me. And so the idea that an episode of Song Exploder might make somebody feel that way, like that's the most gratifying idea I think ever. Separately, my own experience of like making it is a little bit bittersweet, because I know there are people out there who probably like their medium is radio or podcasting, you know, like that's the thing that they want to do. That's the thing that they have been working towards. And for me, it's been music my whole life. And when I'm making the podcast, I'm not making music. Like I'm spending so many hours every week after week, not making music. And it's a little bit weird because I'm still working with music. I'm talking about, or not talking about, but I'm working around other people's music. So I think there's something, I don't know, a little bit sad to me about that, because I guess I had enough success with as a musician that I was able to do it full time for a few years. I certainly wasn't famous and I wasn't rich, but I felt like I was doing my work, you know, and I was making my living doing the thing that I wanted to do. Now I do this other thing, and I'm still making music. But and part of even starting Song Exploder was like kind of an economic decision, because that place where I was, that kind of like lower middle class of working musicians, it's getting harder and harder to like live like that. Either you've got to be a star or it has to be a hobby. And so the fact is, I didn't become a star. I'm not a star when it comes to music. And I had to kind of think of it a little bit more like a hobby. Making Song Exploder means I have to bring all of those experiences and connections and things that I got from making music for 15 years, you know, the meticulous way that I would make music, all those things are like being brought to bear to make this show. And so in some ways it's really nice, the culmination of a lot of things, but I don't feel only happy about it. You know, you brought up Marc Maron.
He's another unhappy person.
You know, I love that show because, and I wanted to make Song Exploder kind of modeled after his show in some ways, even though the form of it is so different. There was this intrinsic thing of like feeling like you're skipping the introductory layers and you're going into something more like intermediate or advanced when you're listening to him and another comedian talk. They have the vernacular of people who have been in the trenches in a particular way that, and me talking to a comedian, I'd never get to have that kind of connection. And so I get to hear things, you get to the meat of it and the truth of it in a way that you wouldn't if they didn't have this shared,
vocabulary.
Craft. Yeah. And so that was something that was really inspiring, but I also always felt, And, you know, and it's much more clearly on display in his show because he's such a part of it. And so often the conversation becomes about his own feelings and his own career. You know, my first episode I heard with him was the one with Louis. And I was kind of presented with this idea of like, oh, Marc Maron has this really successful podcast. And the podcast is more successful than his career as a stand-up comic. His yeah. career as a stand-up comic is what fueled the podcast. And without it, it wouldn't be so successful. But here he is talking to people who, you know, in many cases have much bigger careers than he does. And you can hear that he's sad about it and even like bitter about it sometimes or resentful. And sometimes that stuff comes out and it's really, it makes for fascinating listening. You know, sometimes I think about how I'm like that too. It's not an awesome thought.
No, I think a lot of people would empathize with that. It's interesting that whatever our reality is, we sort of draw its distance from a sense of fantasy, even when the reality has got a lot of overlap with that sort of original view. It must be partially that Song Exploder is such a success that it feels like a starkly, the contrast is realized.
Hmm. Yeah. Then there's the other part of it too, where I'm like, oh, the podcast is more successful than, my records were. But then there's the same instinct that makes me feel bad about the records. I feel bad about the podcast where I'm glad I've gotten to 100 episodes, but I'm always thinking of like, why isn't this show bigger? Like, why, what am I doing wrong? Why can't I get a bigger audience for it? And part of it, and this is part of where like my experience dealing with these kinds of thoughts about music have kind of come through too a little bit, where, you know, not everything is made for a mass audience. There are things where even at its best version, the best executed version of it, it's something that's going to only appeal to like a certain number of people, and maybe like a highly meticulously produced show about a musician taking apart a song, it's not going to have the same kind of appeal as a suspenseful, serialized true crime drama.
Well, the whole scale of all of this stuff is just mind-boggling now compared to, you know, when you look at even a lot of like great records, how, you know, little they sold at the original time, or even the scale of like a print magazine like The New Yorker, which is like had this massive cultural influence for decades and decades and decades and has under 1 million subscribers.
Right.
You know, there's a weird inflationary sense of people out there that doesn't necessarily match like how art has been pacing itself over the last 100 years or so.
Yeah, this is something that I think about all the time, which is like trying to figure out how to get back to viewing music and podcasts, whatever, like any kind of like creative output, the way that I did when it wasn't my job. That when I was in college and just loved, you know, whatever band or whatever film, I wasn't thinking at all about like, oh, well, what were the box office receipts like? Or, you know, what are the sound scan numbers?
Yeah. It flopped.
I worked for a little while at a record label, the record label that the 1AM Radio was signed to. I was the creative director there. And it was a really great experience for me in a lot of ways. But I also think that in some ways it was like profoundly damaging to my like self-esteem as a creative person, because I was actively engaged with the business. And more importantly, I saw how people outside of the people who were making the music kind of dealt with the reality of that. You know, like how much the direct correlation between like, oh, these are your sound scan numbers, these are the kinds of attention and resources you're going to get from the label. Because of that attention, these are the kind of narrative that gets pitched, if something gets pitched at all, out into the world. And then this is how people out in the world like end up receiving it. It was this crazy thing that made me feel like having a hit or having commercial success was so, so important. Whereas when I was, you know, 19, like who cared how many copies the 7-inch that I bought, like I saw a band in a basement and I loved them so much and I bought a 7-inch and I listened to it every day for like 3 months and I thought it was the greatest thing and super profound, and that was what was important to me. And when I was making stuff, I would be like, I want to have that feeling, I want to have that kind of connection with somebody, I want to make something that's important to one person as this one record was important to me.
I haven't listened to every episode, but I can't really think of a Song Exploder episode where someone's explanation of the song has to do with the music business or has to do with labels or money or advancing the career or anything like that. Is that stuff get edited out or does it, you just naturally radiate, that's not what I'm interested in?
No, those stories do sometimes come in and I actually really love them. There's one that in particularly that I really love, which is the Peter, Bjorn and John episode about young folks. That song is such a massive hit. And that band became so huge. I felt like to me, like overnight based on that one song. I was a big fan kind of immediately. And one of the things I loved about it was the drum sound in that record. But then it turned out that the reason why the drums sounded the way they did is because on the record they had made before, they had had this feeling of like, we're going to take over the world. And they spent a lot of money on the record thinking that they were going to be like a huge hit then. And then that record didn't end up doing that for them. They didn't have that kind of commercial success. And it was like super disappointing for them. And they thought that that might be it. They almost broke up as a result of it, as a result of like the lack of, you know, commercial success. They decided to make one more record, but in reaction to it, they had made it super cheap. Just like, well, you know, we're not going to try that again. We're not going to invest all this money into something in case it doesn't work out. And so they recorded it in their like practice space and that had bad acoustics in there. And so they couldn't record the drums with cymbals because the cymbals would sound terrible. So they had to do this other kind of miking and ended up making this drum sound that to me as a producer is like one of my favorite drum sounds that's ever been in a record. And that was all because of this reaction that came out of like a purely commercial music industry kind of part of their story.
I have a theory about you that I don't know if it's true or not, but it's something I think about when I listen to your show. In the same way that like in Marc Maron, his meeting with Lorne Michaels just comes up over and over again. And you could almost like describe Marc Maron's entire life history as like being projected through the lens of him meeting Lorne Michaels and not getting a job on Saturday Night Live. But I've noticed that there is a hugely overrepresented number of theme songs on Song Exploder. Do you identify with the writers of theme songs?
Well, I came out to LA because I wanted to do film scores. I was doing my band on the East Coast and I felt like I could do that from anywhere, but I really wanted to write music for films. And I felt like the only way I could do it, I tried to do it in New York and it didn't end up working out for me. I couldn't make those connections and it just felt like there wasn't enough of a scene or whatever. I wasn't tapped into it. So I ended up coming out to LA specifically for that reason. So that is like a huge interest in for me. But then there's also, I think like it's from a purely strategic business kind of move. It's a good thing for me to do because you get to tap into sometimes like two different sets of audiences. I did an episode with the BoJack Horseman theme that was written by Patrick Carney of the Black Keys. And suddenly all these people who love BoJack Horseman, which are millions of people, plus all the people who like the Black Keys, I get to appeal to all of them. You know, like I get to spread the net further with that. You know, to the extent that I'm just trying to like drive up the numbers for the sake of the business of Song Exploder, or the sake of the viability of the show, both in terms of like being able to book artists and say, hey, look, this many people listened to the last episode, or to say to sponsors, hey, look, people are actually downloading this show. There's like a strategic aspect to it as well. And also like, as opposed to a song in a movie, people are watching shows. They might see 10 episodes. They get to hear that same piece of music 10 times. And so they end up having like a real connection with it. And I end up having a connection with it as well. So it ends up looming kind of large in my brain.
My final question, where do you go from here?
Oh, I have no idea. I think I'm trying not to think about it too much. This is one of the other advantages of having the schedule established for you. And one of the things that is really paralyzing about making music, you know, when you're like, oh, I'm making a record and there's no deadline and it's just up to me to come in here every day and figure it out. There's something nice about the relentlessness of like, well, I have to start working on the next episode immediately because it's got to come out in 10 days and I have at least 12 days of work left on it. So it kind of prevents me from having a macroscopic view of anything. I just have to keep my head down and get the next episode out.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Aaron. It was awesome talking to you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Janelle Pfeiffer, who edited this show, and to our intern, Courtney Harrell. Of course, to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thank you to our sponsors, MeUndies and MailChimp. As I said at the beginning of the show, I have a new podcast out. It's called Stoner. It's conversations with interesting, creative people who enjoy marijuana. If you want to hear a little bit more of the show, just keep listening. I'm going to play a little teaser for it here. All right, see you next week. Hey, I'm Aaron Lammer. I have a new show coming out. It's called Stoner. I myself enjoy marijuana and have for many years. So it's been fun buying legal marijuana for the first time and seeing people's attitudes change. And I think that means that a wider swath of people are trying and often really liking it. And I'm curious who they are, and so I'm going to go seek them out and talk to them about it. Who am I? I am a podcaster. I started a literary site called Longform. I write songs with Francis and the Lights. We've done work with Drake and Kanye West and Bon Iver. We toured all winter with Chance the Rapper. Anyway, all the places my life takes me, I meet creative, interesting people who enjoy marijuana. And I love talking about it with them. So that's the inspiration for this show. We'll be talking to artists, musicians, people in science and technology, people who work within the marijuana economy, but mostly people who consume it. I think we'll start with questions like, when was the first time you ever smoked weed? And just see where that can take us. Because a question like that asks a lot of things. It asks where you're from. Who did you hang out with when you were in high school? What did your parents think? I've done a few of the conversations already. They're funny. They're very human. So I encourage you to subscribe. The iTunes page is up now. The first episode will be available shortly. I look forward to seeing you then.